Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. We're going to talk about kinky sex again, because kinky is often about having fun with sex, and it's often about introducing imagination and creativity into lovemaking. And to help me with this discussion is a real expert. He's been on before. We're so happy to have you back, Dr. Hernando Chavez. He's a licensed marriage and family therapist and a doctor of human sexuality in Beverly Hills, California. And welcome back, Hernando. I'm so pleased that you're on this program again. You offer so much.
Well, hello, Dr. Wiley, and thank you so much, Dr. Diana, for having me on today. Los Angeles misses you.
Oh, thank you. Yes, well, I miss Los Angeles, especially the weather, because I'm in Seattle. We have inclement weather a lot, but anyway, there are other very good things in Seattle. But yeah, Dr. Hernando Chavez is also the president-elect for Western Regional Quad-S. Quad-S is Society for the Scientific Study of Sexuality. Did I say that right?
Yes, it is. You said it perfectly.
Yeah, and I've been a member for probably 30 years. Hernando is a little younger than I am, but very wise. Oh, my goodness. And I know you're doing a great job organizing this, and Brian, my significant other, and I are looking forward to being down there the end of April. So we're going to devote at least the second half, maybe the last third of the program, to talking about the conference coming up, because it's really interesting. And you've been very busy, I know, organizing it.
You know, it's been a pleasure, and I'm just excited to be able to bring kink and bring sexual science to individuals like yourself who are professionals, who are working with couples and relationships and really doing presentations to educate the world about sex, sexuality.
Yeah, when we talk about the conference, there are a number of presentations like eroticism, understanding fetish play and safety issues, preventing physical and emotional harm. So we'll talk about more about that. Let's talk a little bit more generally about kink.
Perfect.
Yeah. How did you start to be interested in it? Did it begin from a personal play, or what? How did it happen for you?
I'll tell you what, it's been an evolution process for me in regards to not only my own personal sexuality, but also the professional sexual issues that I prefer and I enjoy working with couples and individuals. As we all know that we're sexually evolving individuals, and we're all so filled with diversity, and to me, I think the diversity is what is most interesting and most attractive to me, whether it's fetishism or kink or something outside that mainstream box. It's just something that really invigorates me and makes me feel passionate, because these people don't have a voice necessarily to speak from, and for a number of years it's been viewed as negative or pejorative or pathological. And really what we're working at as a field of sexology is trying to normalize and make this not something that people need to hide and put in their as a skeleton in their closet, but instead as something that they can embrace and enjoy.
Yes, and it seems as though, a lot of people think that men in our society are more into kink than women, but I suspect it's because we define kink differently for men than for women. For instance, a woman who wears her boyfriend's boxers or briefs, she could be considered at the height of fashion. Mm-hmm. But if he wears her underwear, we consider him to be weird. Some of us do. I mean, not everybody.
It's a great example, though.
Yeah. And then I'm also thinking about the difference between men and women, that a woman who routinely undresses in front of the open window, well, she's thought to be a neighborhood resource. And double that for a woman who plays with herself with the window shades up. But a man who does these things is considered to be a pervert and may even be locked up. Real difference between males and females.
Big difference. And Dr. Dana, I would love to, maybe get the address of what neighborhoods you're observing this. think a lot of men out there, you know, would love to find out what area of the country you're talking about.
Well, if a couple is into exhibitionism, Brian and I were talking to a couple and about this. They happen to live nearby, their neighbors, and they like to put a red light in their window when they're going to be in front of the window carrying on. I think that's rather creative.
It sounds like the traditional red light district from the origin.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I think it would be helpful for you. We hear the term helpful for us. We hear the term BDSM. So if you could define this for our listeners.
Sure, most definitely. The term BDSM, it's four letters that stands for six different terms: bondage, discipline, domination, submission, sadism, and masochism. And each of those terms, you know, correlates with a different type of behavior and arousal, whether it's physical or psychological. For the bondage, we generally associate that term with restraints, whether it's wrist restraints, rope play, any type of a play that involves restricting a person's access, which can be very psychological arousing for individuals. The second term would be discipline, which would be rules and punishments. So oftentimes people will set up scenarios which often you have like an authoritative or power play that's associated with it, and that can be arousing for individuals. Then we have the D and the S, which would be the dominant submissive perspectives, which are a wonderful couple. The two go hand in hand very, very nicely together, and that's pretty straightforward, whereas some individuals prefer both the physical and the psychological arousal of being the dominant individual that appears to have most of the power, and the submissive aspect, where they appear to relinquish that power to their dominant. However, in true BDSM, we know that the submissive has the total absolute power in the ability to say more or less or stop, which is...
Yeah. There are some women that think that if a woman wants to be submissive, that it is a feminist contradiction. And I would argue that it is not, since the relevant issue of freedom to choose is in place rather than what's being chosen. So the woman gets to choose to be a submissive, and it gives her some power in that. And many, many women, submissives, it turns out, are very successful in their work lives, and they like to relinquish when they're being sexual. They just like to be dominated in the bedroom and give up having to think all the time. Just as men often, who are CEOs of companies, like to be dominated. So it's a role reversal in the bedroom.
Exactly. And when we think about pleasure and arousal, it's really about how are we making ourselves happy. And oftentimes it's about doing things that we, you know, either opposite or things that we aren't doing in our everyday life.
Mm.
Those powerful individuals, I mean, they are in such control of so many aspects of their business and professional life that there's nothing more pleasurable than to be able to just let go, to leave that stress.
Let go.
To allow, you know, pleasure to take over and not have to be the ones to sort of drive and push and be the leader or the one in charge. Instead, sort of be that recipient, the one that can enjoy, can feel, can be mindful of their pleasure. It's really a very arousing aspect for individuals to just do something different than what they're normally accustomed to.
Yeah. Let's also talk, Hernando, about fetishes, because fetishes and kink sex seem to often go together. One of my favorite strip songs, maybe I'm revealing too much, is You Can Leave Your Hat On, which the old film, 9½ Weeks, where Kim Basinger and Mickey Rourke, who looked entirely different back then, I mean, was sort of a handsome rogue, they had a lot of fun with food and sucking and in front of the refrigerator, but then she later did a striptease to You Can Leave Your Hat On. And I think the singer, Randy Newman, I think he wrote that song, and he was really entreating his lover to take off all her clothes except her hat. And so if Mr. Newman couldn't enjoy sex unless the woman had a hat on, then we might say he had a hat fetish. I think of a fetish as, first of all, reliance on a prop, a body part, a scene or scenario in order to get off sexually. And second, the prop can either be fantasized or exist in actuality. Does that kind of fit with your definition of a fetish?
Yes, it does. It does. And they've even expanded that to separate, you know, you mentioned the body part piece. They actually have come up with a term called partialism, which separates from fetish. So they associate fetishism now with non-living, you know, aspects, whether it's articles of clothing, whether it's props, whether it's, you know. But then the partialistic aspect would be certain specific body parts that people require to necessarily have that arousal. And for most fetishes and most paraphilias, it's almost necessary for them to be able to achieve, let's say, orgasm or ejaculation. So it's really a strong, strong, powerful arousal urge.
Mm-hmm. And when I've encountered fetishes, when clients come in for help, most of them don't want to extinguish the kinky behavior or the fetish. Let's talk about fetishes just now. But to be able to, for some, where the fetish is so strong, like they can only get turned on if they see bare feet in nylons or in high heels or whatever, and that's it. So the idea would be to expand their sexual arousal repertoire so that they can be sexually aroused by more than just that, because that's limiting. And some women will feel like if the man feels that this fetish is more important than she is, she may feel diminished somehow.
That's an excellent point. And I think couples do take things personally, especially when it's our arousal templates and sort of the narrowly focused linear abilities that people have when it comes to excitement, desire, arousal, and then finally orgasm and release. You'll find that people vary in that some do want to expand their, you know, sexual scripts and expand those arousal horizons, while others are very happy with the fact that they have found something that works and they just do not want to let that go. So it really depends on the couple, depends on the individual. But most do need some help in regards to coming to terms with how in society or in relationships they can allow this to come out and be confident about, you know, expressing this to their partners or to the outside world.
Yeah. I've noticed, too, that some people refer to the fetish as a compromise mm-hmm. between the fear of human closeness and the need for it. So then the therapeutic work becomes, well, how do we get from the fear and the need to have to embrace
right
human intimacy better, maybe incorporating part of the fetish or the kink into the behavior. But again, this is going to, if the partner needs to be cooperative.
yes.
And if she or he isn't, then it's a bigger problem, usually.
And I actually even had an intake yesterday with an individual who came into my office stating that their nipples were so sensitive that it was reach orgasm. And so for that individual, they're having difficulty with their new partner of 3 months because the partner wasn't understanding of why this was occurring within their relationship. And the individual came in saying, I want to change this. Can I get rid of this, or can I, you know, focus on something else that's more normative or mainstream? And really, it's not so much about changing, is it more about accepting?
Accepting, exactly. You use the word mainstream. It seems as though in recent times, kink has gone more mainstream. The condom maker Durex found in their survey that 24% of adults have had a threesome, and 36% are into bondage.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have people, the mainstream part, you know, we've got people like the singer Rihanna, and she has a hymn to pleasure pain, S&M it's called, and so she sings, sticks and stones may break my bones, but chains and whips excite me. So it seems as though it is going more and more mainstream.
I agree with you, and I think that we've made huge strides in the last 10 to 20 years with allowing the mainstream to embrace kink as something that's not pathological or not something that's a harmful or something that's negative to people. I mean, if you think about movies like The Secretary, which came out, I believe, in 2003, which was about a BDSM relationship, that was a mainstream movie with James Spader and Maggie Gyllenhaal. You've got individuals mm-hmm. like Madonna and Lady Gaga who incorporate a lot of BDSM, you know, leather and latex and outfits and props into some of their songs, in addition to what you mentioned with Rihanna's lyrics. And even in TV, you've got Family Guy and American Dad and some very, very popular shows that allude to different kinky scenes. Although it's in a more humorous fashion, it's still
right.
putting it out on the mainstream. It's putting it on the map for people to start processing, talking about, desensitizing to the you know, the previous, in my opinion, harmful and wrong interpretations of kink being something that's bad for you.
Mm-hmm. I had one client, female, in her 30s, saying that that she and her partner had rented the movie Secretary. You just talked about that,
mm-hmm.
And how she had her significant other spank her every time Maggie Guggenhall's characters got spanked. So they made sort of a game of it, but they got turned on by all the spanking that was in that movie.
Yeah.
And, yeah, spanking is an let's segue into spanking.
Mm-hmm.
I know some people wonder, well, why do some adults enjoy spanking or being spanked? And one theory states that people sometimes sexualize their childhood shame and humiliation. And so they can turn that shame or humiliation into erotic sensations. And, you know, because they now feel like they can control the sexual scene, whereas when they were children, they were helpless.
And
so it's a shift. It's a shift in how you view it. But I think for any kind of spanking that goes on, the people have to be highly aroused to have it happen.
Yes, and what you're describing, because the aspect of psychological arousal is so important when it comes to kink and BDSM, and what we're discussing right now is SM, which would be sadism, which is the infliction of, some will call it pain, but I call it sensation. So it's when,
sensation, okay.
I feel like pain has this, just such a negative association in society that if we use that, I think people are turned off immediately or have these prejudgments. So I like to say sensation. And then the masochism would be the individual who likes to receive the sensation, and they both get erotic pleasure out of this give and take. And what you're bringing up with the spanking, you know, we don't know the exact origins for each, and each person it's going to be different.
Mm-hmm.
For some, as you mentioned, it could be a shame-based or maybe a empowered-based, you know, taking a victimization experience and sort of turning it into this thriving, surviving, empowered, you know, overcoming some of that shame by, in a sense, internalizing it to become a part of you and a mastery. But then there's some people who there's a wiring. We believe there's definitely going to be some neuroscience associated with coming up with the origins of why people enjoy kink or paraphilias or SM.
Yeah. But it sounds like you're agreeing that it often does have its origins in family of origin experience.
You know, it works for some and it works for others, and we don't have.
Yeah. We don't know.
Yeah, we don't have that strong, you know, causal, you know, ability to say, okay, the research suggests that this is what causes this. It's more of, well, there's an association, and for some people there is this, you know, correlation, but it doesn't work for everybody. So each person, I think, is going to have something different in their history that might preclude them to maybe be more prone or more, you know, able to at least access some of this pain and pleasure, you know, receptive areas in the brain.
Yeah. Bondage.
Mm-hmm.
One form of bondage includes having your arms or feet, or maybe both, tied while being kissed or tickled or caressed or otherwise made love to. And I know that in parts of Los Angeles, New York, and Chicago, this type of activity isn't considered bondage, but merely good bedroom technique.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about Seattle, but anyway.
That's why you're there. You're helping Seattle.
Oh, I, you know,
open
yes.
Open the doors.
But I think those are those people that are into light bondage often enjoy it because they are rendered passive and they have no choice but to totally enjoy what the partner is doing to them. And they don't have to worry about being a good sex partner who provides pleasure in return. So what this does is it eliminates performance anxiety. And that's a good thing for lots of folks. They can just be done too. They can be rendered passive and their partner can tickle them or put a feather on their body and all of that. Do you think that that plays a part, the passivity and just being done too is kind of a turn on?
Oh, I think it's very powerful for people, mm-hmm. and I couldn't agree with you more that for a number of individuals, not having that anxiety of having to be the person to perform this on someone or to be the expert, and also gives us a chance to be more mindful and in tune with what our pleasure sensation is, with the arousal that helps us, because we're no longer focused on our partners, but now we can just put the magnifying glass on ourselves and what turns us on. For a lot of people, if they know their partner's turned on by this, they love to relinquish some of that responsibility and that control.
Mm-hmm. I did a lecture recently, and they wanted it to be edgy. This is a kind of a high-powered business group, so we brought in Mistress Matisse for about a fourth of the talk, toward the end of my talk, and we showed a little bit of Candida Royale's movie Three Daughters, where, I mean, this movie was made probably 25 years ago, but it shows a couple where her hands are being tied up against the bedposts with scarves. And Mistress Matisse pointed out, and I've since read, even by a bondage enthusiast, William Henkin, he says that professionally made cuffs may seem expensive to couples who simply like to tickle and spank, but they are much safer than the restraints mm-hmm. that people improvise at home. And that is because sometimes these things can be hard to undo, the knots, the scarves, and that sort of thing. And then, I think there are further safety concerns, and if any body part that is tied up feels numb or goes to sleep, it needs to be untied immediately. You never tie anything around your partner's neck. And then, I like this as a safety consideration, in anticipation of catastrophes like a fire or earthquakes or even an unexpected visit from your mom or dad. Be sure to have a flashlight or a pair of heavy scissors handy. And paramedic scissors may be the best because they can be found at medical supply stores and they can cut through almost anything except handcuffs. And so I think it's good to keep scissors and flashlights in a place that can be readily found in the dark. And the handcuff key could even be tied to the handcuffs with a string. And then you should talk about the safe word, because that's a big concern with safety, with BDSM and all that.
I'll tell you what, Dr. Diana, you brought up a number of very, very important aspects of BDSM, which is this idea of safety.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the best players and the people that are truly able to experience the most pleasure, eroticism, arousal, and get the most fulfillment and enjoyment are the ones who have safety down pat. They're the
mm-hmm,
people that
mm-hmm,
have
yeah.
mastered it, so they don't necessarily have to be overly analyzing or thinking about those because it's second nature to them. And you're bringing
yeah.
incredible examples. What the illusion I got when you had mentioned tying a person to the bedpost was, even if it wasn't a fire, an earthquake, or something, you know, a catastrophe, what if it was the bed breaking? And let's say the mask,
yeah.
you know, that could happen. I mean,
yeah.
the pull that could occur on the wrist can dislocate a shoulder, can do damage to the wrist.
Yes.
And if you don't have those surgical scissors close by, who knows what damage can happen. And if you're not able to cut the rope or whatever you may be using, I recommend for people to use as a starter book a book called SM 101 by Jay Wiseman. It is just an incredibly safety-focused book.
SM 101. Mm-hmm.
It's really good. It's well-written. Maybe a little more focused on the safety than maybe some people would enjoy, but you got to get that safety down before. You know, and the safety part is also included in there as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So a lot of this has some ritualistic aspects to it, too, doesn't it?
Most definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. And for people in the right space mentally, this can add to the sexual arousal and maybe take some of the anxiety out. Because we know we're going to do this next, and it's consensual, and we've talked about it, and we've got the safe words, and the pleasure pain. The pain is not so much pain. It's interpreted as more of what do you think for some people? Maybe invigorating and intimate, or
I think it could be a lot of different things for people. Those who truly do find it a lifestyle oftentimes will experience more than just the sensation aspect, but more of like a spiritual and energy exchange with their partners.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we talk about, you brought up, you know, the idea of communication, and there's a very important aspect of pre-negotiation that needs to occur for people to understand how to truly consent to some of these behaviors and activities.
Mm-hmm.
So they're very lengthy. There are even checklists that individuals will go through that can be pages and pages long, where people will go over different items such as what positions do you prefer, what injuries you may have, what is acceptable, what is unacceptable, what are my limits. And then when we describe safe words, essentially a safe word is the more classic would be kind of like our stoplights, which would be red, yellow, green. Green, keep going. Yellow, stay where you're at and be aware that, you know, we're almost on the edge. Red is immediate stop. And some individuals will incorporate an actual word that is completely non-sexual that a person knows if they hear it, this is the moment where we have to stop and check in on our partner.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it can't be yes or no, or it can't be, you know, harder or deeper. It's got to be something, you know, elephant or, you know, Seattle.
Speaking of Seattle, this was a couple of years ago. I had a dancer as a client, in, you know, she danced nude, and she was talking about her safe word with her bartender boyfriend, and her safe word was sprinkles, but she'd say it, and he wouldn't listen to her, and so he perversely wanted to see her body with bruises on it when she was dancing, bruises that he inflicted. So I suggested to her that this was not a very healthy relationship. And
I'll tell you what, I couldn't agree with you more.
She got out of it, which was a good thing, I think.
When I heard that right now, that actually brought up, for me, the idea of non-consent, coercion, and even abuse and rape. I mean, that to me is crossing lines, and that's the trust and boundaries and respect that this community thrives on, and it's essential for safe, you know, sane, consensual BDSM. I'm really happy to hear that you talked to her about some of these.
Yeah, thank you.
Deals.
Well, we're going to continue this discussion after the break. A little bit before we start talking about the Quad S Western Regional Meeting, I think the listening audience would be interested in some of the history of BDSM, the Marquis de Sade, and also what Kinsey uncovered. We'll talk about that, and then I also mostly that, and then let's begin to talk about some of the topics that will be covered in the Quad S meeting, and the listeners can rest assured that I'll give a report after going to the meeting. So stay with us. We'll be back. Thank you. We're back. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, and I'm here today with Dr. Hernando Chavez. And, you know, we've been talking about kinky sex, but we haven't used the word power play. And really, that's what a lot of this is about, is power play. Right, Hernando?
Most definitely. The exchange of power is essential for people to enjoy and experience pleasure.
Yes. And so I promised the listening audience that we would talk just a little bit about the history, because maybe we should have done that at closer to the top of the show, but some people listening might find some of this discussion a bit shocking. And so I think it's worth remembering that unorthodox sex wasn't just invented.
Mm-hmm.
The Marquis de Sade, he's the granddaddy of and the hero of sadism. He kicked up his heels and probably a few other things in the 1700s. So that's a long time ago. And a little more about the history. James Joyce, writing to his wife in 1909, confessed an obsession with her underwear. The more pungent, the better. And then we go back to 1953, and Alfred Kinsey's Sexual Behavior and the Human Female reported that, he reported at the time, and this was fairly shocking information, that as many as 1.2% of women had repeatedly engaged in bestiality. And, of course, this is sex with animals. Not some women like to masturbate with a stuffed animal, but this is real unstuffed animals. And this was the 1950s. And now I've read that there are some, this is surprising to me, but some 17 million web pages referring to bestiality. So you had a statistic when we were talking off the air about Kinsey. Mm-hmm. Your statistic was even higher in terms of bestiality, but maybe that included the men.
That's what did it. I mean, you include the men who are more often, men are more often associated with alternative behaviors and sexual practices. So you'll find that the majority of fetishes will be by men. And if a man has one fetish, he's very high rate of having a second or additional fetishes.
Interesting.
So when you put in Kinsey's study, when you add the male numbers into that, it comes to about 8%, 8.6% of individuals had engaged in at least one experience of animal contacts. So those men skew the numbers.
But don't you think at that time, too, when he was doing the research in the late 40s and early 50s, that a lot of these men who reported having sex with animals had grown up on farms?
Most definitely. And if we think back to the rural time period, you know, the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, when Kinsey was at his, you know, peak with his research, you know, the farm country, the heartland was at its peak, and we had miles and miles in between, you know, individuals that lived with each other. So the access to animals or the access to sexual outlets was much more limited to outlets and much more accessible to, let's say, animals. So for most of the people in his samples, they were individuals who tried it out, you know, very few times, maybe one time or more, more for their curiosity than it really was about the attraction. It was pretty much to express some of their erotic desires in their youth and teenage years.
Yeah. Good. Good. Well, let's move on then to the conference.
Okay.
And I know you've been working hard. You are the chairman in charge of this. I guess you have a committee, but
mm-hmm.
Of getting the speakers, and it's a big job, I'm sure. And it's coming up. It's the 2012 Western Regional Meeting for the Society for the Scientific Study of Sexuality. And the program or the title of the meeting is On Being Sexual, Innovations in Thought and Science. And I'm so glad that Brian and I will be arriving in time on Thursday for the evening opening plenary. And the title of this is Vice, Virtue, and the Brain's Pleasure Circuits. And this is a Johns Hopkins University neuroscience and author of The Compass of Pleasure, How Our Brains Make Fatty Foods, Orgasm, Exercise, Marijuana, Generosity, Vodka, Learning, and Gambling Feel So Good. What a great title.
Doesn't that sound like a Vegas weekend?
Absolutely. That's good. So your program says whether eating, taking drugs, engaging in sex, or doing good deeds, the pursuit of pleasure is a central drive of the human animal and explains how pleasure affects us in the most fundamental level in our brain. I can hardly wait for that. I'm going to take copious notes, and of course I love to bring back some of these newfound materials information to my listening audience on Love, Lust, and Laughter on the Progressive Radio Network. How did you manage to get this guy? Because he's from Johns Hopkins University, very prestigious.
Very prestigious, and we're excited to have our conference open up with Dr. David Linden. You know, the future of sex research and sexual science is going to be with neuroscience, at least in part. You know, starting off with Alfred Kinsey, who was really our first U.S. American sex researcher, who was studying more about behaviors, and that was the numbers that he was studying and researching. Now we're looking more into what is the origins and the drives that people have from a physiological perspective. With the advancements in technology and the medical instruments we can now use for recording, it's kind of this new area of exploration for us. It's almost this frontier that's been unexplored. If you think about the Old West or if you think about space, I mean, it's really exciting for a number of sexologists to now have a different perspective to dig and uncover and research.
Yes, and it brain research obviously has been made much easier starting, I think, in the decade of the 1990s with functional MRIs where their brains could be studied.
Yes.
So that's going to be a great opening plenary. And then you have on Friday morning, and as usual, they're concurrent sessions. I'm going to have trouble because I want to go to everything. But the Bonobo Way, an alternate great ape paradigm for human sexual behavior. And Dr. Christopher Ryan and his wife, psychiatrist Dr. Casilda Jethra, wrote this wonderful book, Sex at Dawn, The Prehistoric Origins of Modern Sexuality. Brian and I went to hear him speak in Seattle, and I got him to sign my book. I recommend this book to everybody. It's creatively conceived, it's well written, it's fully documented, it's entertaining. Anyway, they make, for instance, instead of conceiving humans as inherently competitive and warlike like chimps, they conceive of humans as inherently relaxed and cooperative like bonobos. Mm-hmm. And bonobos, if you see films of them, they're having sex all the time. If they have a conflict, they have sex. Make love, not war. That's their motto, I guess. This should be a very interesting.
Very well said. And I spoke to Dr. Susan Block, who will be the presenter on
yes.
the presentation, and she was just fantastic in giving me information as to what she's going to discuss. And something that I learned from her was that bonobo chimps actually have a more of a feminized matriarchal society where women do have power in their communities. They're able to either incorporate the sexuality as a way to, like you mentioned, decrease conflict or curb conflict, and then it can also be used to, really in a sense, give them more of a place in society. When we look at these other historical cultures where the patriarchal perspective was more dominant, and she also, you know, it was explained to me kind of the roles and the, you know, rituals that they would engage in, which is fascinating, considering the fact that we share 90% of our DNA with bonobo chimps. We are very close ancestors. The ability for us to use our higher order functioning in our brain kind of separates us to have this idea of, you know, different choices and different abilities to process information. But in our core evolutionary foundation, we share a lot of similarities.
Yes. And the concurrent session, another one, is by our good friend and colleague, Stella Resnick. I've known Stella for many, many years, and of course her book, The Pleasure Zone, is such a popular book. It was published in 1999, and it still sells very well. The Pleasure Zone, Why We Resist Good Feelings and How to Let Go and Be Happy. And she's very sort of attachment theory oriented, and so she's doing session 3 Friday morning, Sex and the Science of Mind Reading, a multidisciplinary look at empathy and sex drive. That should be very interesting. Her second book is due out in May. So she promised me she'd be a guest on this program. She's been a guest in the past, including when I had a radio show in Hawaii. So I'm hoping to have her on to talk about that second book after it's published.
She will be a wonderful guest. I can't wait to hear.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. And then I love Berta Davis's, the title is great, Magic, Madness, and Melancholy of Monogamy. And you took a class from Berta once. Tell us about that.
Yes. Berta is a professor. She does a joint class with a UCLA doctor named medical doctor named Walter Breckman.
Mm-hmm.
They do a year-long program at UCLA here in Los Angeles for mental health therapists. So it's a three-part program, about 3 months each, and they go over the physiological aspects, the medicalized aspects, the sexological, psychological, sociological, you know, all these different components, from whether it's research to kink, and really trying to educate therapists to be better at sexuality.
Exactly. Good. Good. Mm-hmm. And then I would like you to comment on the next plenary, and I'm really excited about this, How Explicit Sexual Media Shapes and Reflects Desire, with Nina Hartley. Oh, Nina Hartley, former porn actress, RN, has made a lot of sex education films since her performance days as a straight-ahead porn actress.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, who is Jim Stagliano? Who is that? Is he a porn actor?
He is. He's a porn actor and producer and director. So he owns a company called Evil Angel, and he used to be known as, his stage name was Buttman. That was kind of his. So he had a, you recall him?
He's no.
Very, very big. If anybody,
I'm just
liked,
laughing at his stage name.
I'll tell you what. Anybody who liked butts back in the day would have known him. His work was famous. He had magazines, videos. So he liked big butts and a lot of, you know, anal focused material. And he actually, one of the individuals, so we've only had a few individuals in pornography contract HIV, and so he did contract HIV out of the country. So a number of individuals who have become positive have contracted it from other countries. So within, you know, the United States, it's been a much more safe and a harm reduction method of testing and following up. So he's going to give a different point of view as well.
Yeah, and how about Kadrian Cross? Who is that?
She is a current adult film actress. So Nina Hartley is a more of a longtime advocate and AVN Hall of Fame actress. Kaden has won the last year. She won two different awards for Performer of the Year. So she's a hardworking individual in her mid-20s, kind of at the peak of her stardom. So we're trying to get individuals who have both youth experience, you know, different perspectives. You know, Dr. Nina Hartley is actually a doctor. Not many people know about this, and she doesn't tell people. But she has an institute doctorate from the Institute for the Advanced Study of Human Sexuality. So she is an excellent sex
educator. Well, she's a smart cookie.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And she's still, I think she's now must be in her early 50s, still very attractive with such an interesting history. She was featured in a Playboy magazine about a year and a half ago, Whatever's Happened to, you know, former porn stars. And she has made her life very relevant, I think.
She has, and she's one of the people that stayed in the business, and she evolved. So she, not only does she still do you know, erotic work today, but she also does a lot of advocacy, a lot of free speech, volunteer work. She's come into my class even a number of times to speak about pornography and free speech issues. So she's
great.
She's really about, you know, promoting sex positivity.
Yeah, I did get to meet her a couple of times through my friend Candida Royale, because Nina Hartley has, in years past, performed in a number of Candida Royale's films. For those of you not familiar with the name, Candida Royale was the first female director-producer on the scene in 1984, after Candace, her real name, she had been a performer, and she had the right sense that people were able to watch explicit films more at home and got them out of the adult theaters where you would, you know, the stereotype was the trench-coated men, you know.
Yes.
So, but Candace was the first one to really make female-friendly porn, and where there's a plot and nice lighting, and she prefers to call her films erotic rather than pornography.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Hernando, you know the difference between, one difference between erotica and pornography? In pornography, you use the whole chicken. In erotica, you use just the feather.
That's beautiful. I like that.
Anyway, so you said to me off the air in terms of this, how explicit sexual media shapes and reflects desire. What about arousal templates in men?
Watch
a lot of porn.
Yeah, what we were talking about, and this was more of us two therapists discussing this, is that it seems more prevalent for especially men who focus their erotica outlets on pornography and erotica to sort of gain this sexual script, this more narrowly focused idea of what arouses them and what gets them off. And it does impact people in the bedroom and in their relationships because some people get so focused on this linear A to B kind of line that it impacts their ability to be sexual with their partner because their partner might not be able to fulfill their fantasies and desires on that specific linear, narrowly focused perspective. For some people, it does, you know, accentuate their relationship to watch erotica, and for others, it can do some, you know, some harm or some damage.
I think for a lot of guys who watch a lot of pornography, and the typical term is they're addicted. A lot of us prefer the word compulsive about it, but anyway, whatever. There are some theories about their brain chemistry actually changing.
Yes.
And their expectations that their partner will be just ready to go and so enthusiastic and don't necessarily have to slow things down and have more foreplay, and we can just get right away to fucking, which I can say on this internet radio. But you know what I'm saying.
You know, I do, and I think you bring up an excellent point that should be addressed, which is there is evidence that suggests that there are neurological changes.
Yes.
In our brain chemistry and our
yes.
brain functioning with
yes.
any type of compulsive behaviors that are arousing, that are stimulating. But there's also, it could be expressed in either positive or quote-unquote negative manners. And, you know, we can fall in love, and our
yeah.
brain chemistry and brain functioning will change, and that can be a beautiful, wonderful thing. And it can also change if we start harboring maybe more compulsive behaviors with, whether it's sexually or with food or with exercise or whatnot. So, you know, even though people do have some evidence that's suggesting this, we have to also be aware that there's evidence on both sides, that our brain changes constantly. Our brain is not a stagnant organ.
Right.
It is diverse and always evolving. So to say that, you know, too much porn will cause brain changes is kind of misleading and a bit, I think, it doesn't encompass the entire spectrum of what the discussion is about, which is our brain is always changing.
Well, that'll be a fascinating plenary. And then you go on for more sessions at the 2012 Western Regional Meeting, which will be at the Biltmore Millennium in Los Angeles. And we touched on this in the first half of the program, Eroticism, Understanding Fetish Play and Safety Issues, Preventing Physical and Emotional Harm. So that's going to be very good. And then you have Kinky Women Research Study, Preferences and Diversity of Behaviors of Women from the Kink Community, Satisfaction and Commitment and Power Exchange Relationships in the BDSM and BDSM culture, subculture. So all of this will be very illuminating to certain portions of the attendees. And I think it's about time. We haven't had, good for you, because we haven't had too much of the kink stuff in past conferences. And as I revealed, I've been going to them for 25 years at least, maybe more.
You know, Dr. Diana, you're one of our most loyal members, and you're a staple in the Western region, so we love and appreciate that your feedback and also your attendance. And to hear you say that, you know, brings a lot of pleasure for me, because our hope was to try a few different, you know, whether it's including more pornography, including more BDSM or kink, including some neuroscience. Mm-hmm. Traditionally, you know, we need to expand in order to, I think, not only increase our knowledge base, but also to bring in new people, because this idea of sexual science, it may not strike people as important, but it's really what people use in order to normalize and understand that, you know, that their behaviors are safe or consensual or even common. Even going back to the BDSM discussion we had, I mean, with Kinsey talking about his reports, you know, he found that about 55% of females and 50% of males responded or reported having erotic arousal from being bitten. And I think, you know,
from the forbidden, yes, that's very common, sure.
You know, for half people, they like to, you know, their partner to bite them. I think that's really powerful for people to know. And if we don't do the studies, we don't know if this is really true.
Yes, the forbidden. There can be often so much pleasure in the forbidden, and that's why sometimes interjecting a little bit of kink can help couples. I've learned that even the hottest couples go through cool periods, and an infusion of kink can get the fires burning again.
Oh yeah. You know, and people sometimes think that you have to spend enormous amounts of money to purchase material and things to use in your kink world. And really, you can go to a 99 cent store and spend $5 and find a spatula that you can use for spanking. You can take your, you know, four or five pairs of your partner's panties, get a rubber band, tie them together at the end, and you can use that as sort of a little mini erotic lace flogger, you know, for you know, kind of these light spanking slash whippings. You know, people can do a lot of things, scarves that they can use, or even ties, as long as they know to allow some space in the wrists or, you know, the ankles. They can use this to tie up their partner very gently. It doesn't have to be this extremely pricey adventure. It can be something fun, safe, and very economical.
I'm hearing the music, Hernando, so we're going to have to sign off. I'll put it in the description of this show, but what's the best way for people to reach you or to learn more about you?
Sure. My website is drhernandochavez.com, or you can find me on Twitter or Facebook at Hernando Chavez, ending with an S.
Very good. Thanks again, Hernando. You know, this has been a great discussion, and we've, I think, gotten the word out that we want to keep everything safe and fun and not dangerous when we're doing kink. And then this conference is going to be great, you know, and I'll come back to the listening audience with some reports. But thank you so much, Hernando. Another great program. We'll have you back again.
Thank you so much, Dr. Diana. If I could just add one last thing to the conference, go to www.sexscience.org for information.
Sexscience.org, yes. That's right. Thank you. Bye-bye, everybody.
Thank you, Dr. Diana.
Thank you.